Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. Greg Kokol on Stand to Reason, and I'm so glad that you've joined me today. Just made it in under the wire here, raining like cats and dogs here in Southern California. Feels like Seattle to me. I guess it's good for the water level or something. But anyway, we have 2 hours inside thinking about the critical issues of life. Ethics, values, and religion. It's our time every week to reflect on those things. This, of course, Stand to Reason, the marketplace of ideas where issues of philosophy and religion are discussed right here in the open forum of talk radio. And the lines are open for your calls, 1-800-227-5278. And that, of course, all over the country. And if you're in the 714 area code right close to me, don't dial the 800 number. Just dial me local at 754-4150. And you can ask a question about the Bible or your sharing your faith or some theological issue or take exception with something that I've said in the past. That's fine, too. Give me a piece of your mind. That's the rule that we have here at STR. Some of you might know, I don't know if I announced this last week, we've started a blog at Stand to Reason. We've entered the blogosphere, and I think we started making entries on Sunday. If you go, or rather, on Monday, so I'm not sure if I mentioned it here, but this is a way. A lot of people don't know what a blog is, apparently. A blog is a web log. That is, it's a place for someone to log short entries of things on a particular topic. Sometimes they're reflections of their own on a topic. Sometimes they're links to other sites, the kinds of things they think people who tap into their weblog, their blog, might be interested in reading. And if you're in the political sphere, gaining information from the Internet, you know what a blog is. If you don't know what a blog is, go to str.org. In the upper right-hand side there, you'll see an announcement about our weblog. And just click there into the link, and you'll go right into our log, and you'll see what a weblog or a blog is. So those of you who are familiar with it and you haven't gone to str.org, take a look. We've got a lot of things posted there. Steve Wagner has posted a few things. I've made about 5 postings. The Enforcer has made many more, and actually I think she's come into her own here. She is really good at this. She's good at writing, she's good at reflecting, and she's good at linking you up to things that you might care about. And that's part of what a blog is. It's a portal to other sites, other ideas, other articles that we think that you as our audience might be interested in. So go to str.org and check out our blog. It's not interactive. You can't post your own things there. That's a bulletin board. We already have that. This is for us to post for you. And the Enforcer and our speakers at Stand to Reason will be blogging over time. I'll make 4 or 5 entries a week. That's my goal. Maybe make it 3 or 4, whatever. You'll see my stuff up there. The Enforcer's on it mostly, though, and she'll keep you in touch with the important things happening at the Stand to Reason blog. STR.org. I mentioned to you last Sunday that I was just a couple days before. I taped for a TV show on Faith Under Fire with Lee Strobel, and we were really supposed to tape for just a couple of segments with Deepak Chopra. It turned out we ended up taping for over 40 minutes. They got a huge chunk of time. They thought it was all valuable. They didn't want to whittle it down to a shorter segment, so they decided to devote an entire show to my TV debate, kind of crossfire style, with Deepak Chopra, probably the world's leading New Ager. Has a tremendous influence on people's thinking, and it's not just the New Age ideas that he's promoting, but he has embraced a whole lot of ways of understanding the whole Christian project and attacking the Christian project that a lot of people who aren't New Agers do, and these came up in the show. I hope you get the chance to see the show. I understand it's going to be aired sometime in May. This is on PAX, and so you can keep your eye open on the PAX website. Or just on our own website. As soon as we find out, we'll let you know. Don't call us and ask us for a date. We do not know that. As soon as we know, we'll let you know. And we'd love you to watch it, because I think that there's some things you're going to learn about the other side, how people take shots at what we believe, and how to respond to them. I think this will be very, very educational. I was very happy with the way things went. So we don't know the date. Keep an eye on the internet for PAX TV and Faith Under Fire, and on our website we'll let you know as soon as possible. But we covered a lot of ground in 40 minutes, and I'm not going to give you a blow-by-blow. I talked last week about a couple of things. But one thing did come up in our discussion that I want to talk about because it has broader influence, broader significance than just to that discussion. It has significance to what I think is the most corrosive ideological movement in our culture with regards to Christianity. That means nothing is more damaging to our ability to communicate our faith clearly than this thing, and this idea, broadly put, is relativism in its many forms. Postmodernism is kind of the movement that I think embraces radical relativism in every area. I understand postmoderns don't like to be called relativists, but they're either metaphysical non-realists or epistemological non-realists, and if you're a non-realist in either case, then you're a relativist regarding those issues. That's just the way ideas work. I've properly labeled them. And this has taken on a tremendous amount of momentum in the church with a group that appeals primarily to the younger crowd, the up-and-comers, as it were. And this crowd has been steeped in this postmodern radical relativistic thinking that is very suspicious, even resistant of any, and I'll have to say, absolute truth claims or objective truth claims, though I don't like those phrases. And the reasons I don't like those phrases is because they're redundant. Absolute truth, objective truth, these are redundancies. When I say a thing is true, I mean it's actually so. Saying that it's absolute or that it's objective doesn't add anything to my understanding of the word truth. It's a fact. This is the way it is if my assessment of the circumstances is correct. That is, if my claim, if my belief, if my way of thinking is true in this sense, then it's so, even if others disagree. Now, of course, I could be mistaken about the nature of things, but when I say truth, I mean it in the absolute objectivist sense. And by the way, since postmoderns are resistant to this, they don't like the idea of the concept of truth. They don't think there is truth in the way that we talk about it. There's a reason for this resistance. And by the way, some of you have heard this before, and I'm going to be repeating this over the next year because it's so critical. There's a reason for the resistance. They think that if you think you have the truth, then this becomes a tool of power to oppress those who you think don't have the truth. Now, there are all kinds of concerns that come up when you think of that challenge. You don't have the truth. That's just an attempt to oppress people. Really, you're not telling me that you have an accurate assessment of my use of the truth terminology so that as a matter of fact, in reality, I am using it to oppress someone. You don't mean that, do you? What I've just said basically is that these are people who claim there is no reality. And there is no truth, there are no facts, there are no statements that correspond to the way the world really is, but in the next sentence we'll tell you the way the world is, the way you are, what your motives are, what you're doing, you're oppressing, and that's wrong. You see all the facts, objective, absolute truths that are bound up in that assessment itself coming from postmoderns who say there is no truth. So right away you've got a self-refuting problem there. And, of course, in the conversation with Dr. Chopra last week that will be aired later on, in probably in May, on Faith Under Fire on PAX TV, this was one thing that he resisted tremendously, and that was that you could have that we had the truth. In fact, he characterized people like me, the fundamentalists who think they're right, as dangerous people. We cause wars. We get people hurt. And he's all about peace. But, of course, and I mentioned this last week, his book about peace, the most recent one, and if you go into Barnes & Noble, by the way, I've seen it in the window. You don't even have to go in the building. There's Deepak Chopra right there in the window. Barnes & Noble all around the country and Borders, I'm sure, and the others. The title of his book is Peace Is, watch this, The Way. Excuse me? Peace Is The Way. Now, it doesn't bother me whatsoever that Dr. Chopra thinks he's got the way. It just strikes me as a little bit odd that he's so offended that other people think they have the way, and the nature of his offense is not that they're mistaken in what they think is the way. He's offended that they think they've got the way. Once again, you have the passive-aggressive tolerance trick. We're tolerant, you're not, because you think you have the way. We're open-minded. We think our way is right, but we're open-minded. You see, it just doesn't work, does it? And so what I've been thinking about is, given this resistance of the postmoderns and those postmoderns who are now part of this self-conscious movement in the church, looking to absorb all the young people into this new way of looking at Christianity, this post-evangelicalism called the emergent church that is not simply influenced by postmodernism but embraces it, wraps their arms around it, loves it, thinks it's wonderful, and think that all of the rest of us, as I mentioned earlier, who think we know the truth, are narrow, arrogant, and oppressive. So I want to make a very simple case for the idea that you can know the way the world really is. Now, remember, when you say that your belief or your statement or your point of view fits the way the world really is, that you know the way the world is, that you are saying that your statement is true, and you mean the word truth in the correspondence sense. That is, your claim corresponds to the way the world really is. Now, I hate to throw in these more technical terms, truth as correspondence, because it confuses things for some people. The fact is, truth as correspondence is what you mean when you use the word truth almost every single time you use it. When you say, wait a minute, is that true? The house is on fire. Really, is it true? Someone stole your car. You're kidding me. Really? Is that true? I mean, all of these uses of the concept of truth entail the notion that you want to know if it's actually so. Is it really the way you say it is? And that's almost always what we mean by the word. So I'm just simply employing the common sense definition of the term. Postmoderns, including emergent folks, don't like the concept of truth, absolute truth, objective truth, because then it thinks like we know it all. But can we know anything? They say we can't know anything, therefore we can't know the religious things, so we can just tell the stories that we tell, and hopefully that'll draw people into our narrative. I think we can know something. In fact, I think we know a lot of things. And this was a question that came up on the show. Right towards the end, Lee Strobel asked of us both, I can't remember what Dr. Chopra said, and you'll find out if you catch the show in May when it's aired. But he asked me, Greg, can we know truth? And I gave a very simple response, and this is a response that you can give to anybody, and it's easy, it's simple, it's virtually irrefutable. And it just somewhat amazes me that some of these huge, massive stumbling blocks for people, like can we know truth, are easily resolved with a little common sense reflection. And here's what I said, and you just memorize this, all right? It's easy. I said, Lee, if we can't know truth, we'll be dead tomorrow. Think about it. If we can't know something about the way the world actually is, how can we possibly survive 24 hours? I guess we could if we're just sleeping the whole time. But if we get out of bed, look out. Because what side of the bed are you going to get out of? The side that doesn't have what you think is a wall on it or a window on it. If you get them mixed up, you might walk through the window and die. You get out and you take a shower. If you put the water on too hot, you get scalded. You got to know something about the true nature of your environment to keep from doing that. You go shave yourself. If you don't look carefully and get it right for the most part, you might slit your throat. You go into your kitchen and you make breakfast. If you don't get it right, you're going to burn down the house. Maybe you'll eat poison. You climb into your car. Do you think you can get up far from your driveway without getting it right? You take any medicine? You rely on the doctor? You're a diabetic? Everything we do requires that we know truth. And we have to know lots of it. And we have to know it moment by moment. If we don't, we'll die. And people who don't think they know truth, who think the world around them is a fantasy world, These are the people we put into padded rooms. And I don't mean radio talk show booths. We lock the door so they won't hurt themselves. Because there's a difference between fantasy and reality, ladies and gentlemen. There's a difference between believe and make-believe. I was talking with a friend yesterday about we had another shower for Annabeth Noel. And in a line of them, wonderful people, talking with some close friends just about how babies learn things. Annabeth waves her arms around. As children develop, and they don't have to develop very far, they start learning that that thing that's flying past their face is attached to them. How do they know that? It's not only attached to them, it's theirs, and they can move it. In other words, they develop, even at that early age, a true perception of reality. How do they do that? Because they're attending to their awarenesses. They are aware that something flies by their face, their hand. They are also aware at the same time that there's something going on inside of them that is coincident with that hand flying by the face, an act of willing. And when they pay attention to that, they realize as time goes on, they can control that. They can will to raise the hand and will to drop it and will to do things with it. Annabeth now is at almost 8 weeks. She's pulling things. She uses her hands to pull things towards her mouth, like the bottle or the binky or my hands or something like that. She's acting. She is connecting up her internal awarenesses with the way the world seems to her, and it's working. People who are diabetics can't be postmoderns, because if they didn't know the way their world really was, they would die tomorrow. They can take their awarenesses that this is a medicine that will keep them healthy, they can inject it, and then they stay healthy. You prove that you can know truth every time you dial a phone number, ladies and gentlemen. You have a number in your head that corresponds to someone's home. You go out and you poke those numbers with your fingers. The phone rings, and the person that you had in your mind that corresponded to those numbers now answers the phone. You're talking to them. Do you see how that's a test of correspondence? Now you know that your belief about the world corresponds to the way the world really is. That number did belong to that person. How do you know? You're talking to them. Do you see how foolish this idea is that you can't know truth? It's insane, and it's really surprising to me that so many people are so deeply taken by such a foolish notion. Okay, your call's coming up, 1-800-227-5278, and in the 714 area code, 754-4150, for Stand to Reason and Greg Kogel.
Do you have an important decision to make in your life? Are you looking for God's guidance or leading before you move ahead with the decision you're currently faced with? Well, Greg's teaching on decision-making and the will of God, available on audio cassette or CD, takes you through the scriptures to provide the tools you need to make sound choices. After hearing Greg's teaching, you'll experience a deeper sense of relief and freedom in decision-making than you've ever known before. You'll understand how reading Scripture carefully makes a difference in many different issues, including making decisions. Decision-Making and the Will of God is available today from Stand to Reason in audio cassette or CD format. Extensive notes are included to help you with your study. Simply go to www.str.org or call the office at 800-2-REASON. And order Decision-Making and the Will of God today. You'll be glad you did.
Hi, this is Hugh Hewitt. Want to make a difference for a Christianity worth thinking about? Stand to Reason can help you do just that. STR trains Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting in your area and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You will learn how to deliver a message that is accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a manner that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting STR Radio today. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800-2-REASON or send your gift to 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. Again, 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. And thank you for listening.
I like this. Melinda, you're asking about the music. I like this. A big band sound, kind of. Nice and upbeat. Bright, cheery, kind of like me. Greg Kokel on Stand to Reason, and time to get right to the calls. 1-800-227-5278. We have open lines there. Also in the 714 area code, that's right here in Southern California, 754-4150. And let's see who's up first. Steven, welcome to the show.
Hi, Greg.
Hey, Steve.
I was wondering how I should take 1 Timothy 2, 9 through 15. Can I read that to you?
I have it here. Well, you can go ahead and read it. Go ahead, and now I'll get okay. to it myself. That's 1 Timothy. That's the 1 Timothy chapter 2. That's the section that deals with, well, what many people have thought deals with women in leadership.
Yeah, and I'd like to know what you think about
it. Yeah, I don't think it deals with women in leadership, but we'll go to it directly. Okay. Go ahead.
Likewise, I want women to adorn themselves with proper clothing, modestly and discreetly, not with braided hair and gold or pearls or costly garments,
mm-hmm.
but rather by means of good works, as is proper for a woman making a claim to godliness. A woman must quietly receive instruction with entire submissiveness. But I do not allow a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man, but to remain quiet.
Right.
For it was man who was first created, and then Eve.
Okay, that's good. That covers basically the passage in question, all right?
Yeah.
And so then your question about this passage is what?
What exactly does it mean? Does it mean that women should not have leadership roles in church, or... Mm-hmm. What should we take from this passage?
Okay, let me make a couple of broad observations, all right, and then I'll get down specifically to what I think it means, all right? It's a little different than what other people think it means, but, you know, bear with me, and I'll give you my reasons.
All right.
Notice in chapter 3, verse 1, what does chapter 3, verse 1 start with?
It is a trustworthy statement. If any man aspires to the office of overseer.
Yeah, it's a fine work. Good. It's a fine work he desires to do. In other words, chapter 3 begins a section on church leadership in which it talks about overseers who are elders or presbyters, and it also talks about deacons who are servants. And he gives guidelines for the elders there in chapter 3, and he gives guidelines about deacons in chapter 3. In other words, it is chapter 3 that is the chapter that is explicitly dealing with church leadership. It is not chapter 2. Chapter 2 doesn't speak of church leadership. It talks about the way men and women are operating in the church family, but it is not focusing on church leadership. All right?
Okay,
so that's the first clue here. Secondly, let's just take that passage that you read at face value, as people often take it, that this is talking about the way leadership is to happen in the church. And the directions here is, verse 12, now I do not allow a woman to teach, to read in the church, or exercise any authority over a man in the church, but to remain quiet. So women in the church, according to this passage, must remain quiet.
Okay,
and maybe you might restrict it. Well, he means quiet with regards to teaching. Maybe they don't have to be utterly silent, never speak, but it's quiet with regards to teaching. The verse above it, verse 11, I probably should have started there. Let a woman quietly receive instruction with entire submissiveness. Okay, now that would be submissiveness to who?
I don't know. To God, to man, to...
Well, yeah, the women are supposed to receive instruction from somebody to whom they're supposed to submit, right?
Yeah.
And who would that be then? In the context. Let me read the two verses together. A woman must quietly receive instruction with entire submissiveness, but I don't allow a woman to teach or exercise over a man, but to remain quiet. So if the women are not teaching the men, but they're receiving instruction with entire submissiveness, from whom are they receiving this instruction?
Men.
Okay. So this, on this take, now I'm not telling you my view here, I'm just saying that there is a way of seeing this passage, seeing this passage in terms of church leadership. I said the church leadership passage starts in chapter 3, not in chapter 2. I also said if we understand this, look and see what it's saying. It's saying not only should women never teach men, but women are supposed to receive instruction from men with entire submissiveness. Now, what role would you have, what responsibility then would my wife Steece have to you as a male in the church, if that was the right way to take this?
To receive instruction from me.
Yes, in what way?
In spiritual matters.
Yes, but in what way? From the text. How does it characterize? Receive it how? What's her attitude?
Entire submissive.
Exactly. If this is about church leadership, the way it's often characterized, that means that all women must be entirely submissive to the teaching of all men.
Okay.
Now, I think this is a little bit odd.
I do, too. That's why I'm asking.
Okay. So now I wonder, well, is it possible it could mean something else? And so I actually did some study on this, and I found out that there are words that are used to be translated man and woman here are the Greek words gune, G-U-N-E, woman, and aner, A-N-E-R, in the English transliteration, and that would be a man. Do you know that man and woman is not the only legitimate translation for those two words?
No.
What do you think it's might be Greek another legitimate? Pardon me?
It's all Greek to me.
Yeah, okay. If it can be legitimately translated man and woman, what do you think it might also be legitimately translated as?
Adam and Eve?
Nope. You're warm. Husband?
Husband and wife.
And wife. Okay. How do I know that? Because I looked through the Bible, and in every single case but two, where men and women are pictured in some kind of relationship, it is always translated husband and wife.
Okay.
Unless it's very clear from the context that it's not husband and wife. And so here, they translate it not consistently with the pattern before. Here, the New American Standard guys and most other translators translate it man and woman. But then when you take it as that and leadership in the church, it creates these kind of odd circumstances, plus it seems out of step from the teaching of leadership in chapter 3. So what if we were to instead translate these words, husband and wife, and not man and woman, which is a legitimate option,
okay.
And I wonder if any of the confusion would disappear here. Okay, let's look at it. Let's see. Notice, by the way, in verse 11, and that's the really critical part here, the ones that are the big ones in question, really, the verses. It doesn't say let women quietly receive instruction from men. It says let a woman quietly receive instruction with entire submissiveness, but I do not allow a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man. There are particular people involved here. It's just not general. So who might the particulars be? That makes a lot more sense if you understand this as husband and wife. It then reads, let a wife quietly receive instruction with entire submissiveness. Now the phrase entire submissiveness sounds much more like other places in the scripture that describe the responsibilities of wives to their husbands,
yeah.
Right? Okay. But I do not allow a wife to be the teacher or exercise authority, and some have pointed out that the sense of the words here is to usurp the authority of her husband, but to remain quiet. In other words, be the one who receives instruction. Now, on that take, Paul is identifying the husband as a spiritual leader of the home.
Okay.
He is not saying that women can never say anything in the church. That, to me, flows flawlessly through the passage. It creates no difficulty whatsoever. So I would say this passage does not require that women not be in any capacity teachers in the church, over men, for example, because it's not talking about women and men in the church. Talking about in the church community the relationship of husbands to wives. And notice too that Adam and Eve are the first are used as an example here, and some people say, well, wait a minute, Adam and Eve, that's the example, so it's man and woman. I said, wait a minute, Adam and Eve were also the first husband and wife.
Yeah.
So that can work either direction.
Okay.
Now, just so nobody draws the wrong conclusion with this, I don't think that women should be elders in the church.
All right.
But I don't get that from chapter 2. I get it from chapter 3.
Okay.
if any man aspires to the office of overseer, it's a fine work he desires to do. And then he goes on through the text and describes the requirements for men as overseers and doesn't seem to make room or allow room for women as the overseer, as an elder, as the chief, one of the chief leaders in the church. But they have a full range of responsibilities, including teaching of adults, including teaching of men, as far as I'm concerned, if they have the gift of teaching, as they are part of a larger church that is governed by elders who are all male.
Okay.
Does that seem to make sense to you?
It does.
Yeah, I think that fits nicely, and I know some people get all upset about that, you know.
Yeah.
But I think this is a nicer way of handling chapter 2 and gets... By the way, the other place where they break with that pattern with Aner and Gune is when in the Corinthian passage where it says that man is the head of woman, Christ is the head of man or something like that. You know, this is the other one they point to. But there it could also be husband and wife just as easily.
Okay.
So these are two passages that I think have been used a little oppressively in the past that don't need to be understood that way at all, and very legitimately in the context and with the Greek could be translated otherwise, and I think make a smoother translation. Everything fits much nicer.
It does.
However, I would still say that I think leadership, ultimate leadership in the church, elders, is for men, but because of what Paul teaches to Timothy in chapter 3, not in chapter 2.
Yeah.
All righty?
Okay.
Steve, I appreciate your call. It's a good question and controversial. I imagine I'll get some calls on that one. Let's see, time-wise, how are we doing here? Okay, we can go to Rick. Let me find it. Rick, welcome to Stand to Reason.
How are you doing, Greg?
Doing okay. How are you?
I'm all right.
Good.
I'm having a disagreement with my pastor.
Mm-hmm.
Over tongues. We're a charismatic church kind of moving towards Pentecostal.
Okay. That would mean that you're not as wild as you could be.
That's right.
Okay.
And not openly and not normally in public.
Right. Yeah. I guess these are kind of cultural distinctions, but since the Jesus movement, the charismatic, and the coincidence of a kind of the Jesus movement and the charismatic movement there in the 70s, you've got this new range of charismatics that are kind of a little bit more charismatic about their faith. They're more exuberant in worship and stuff, and there's an openness to the gifts moving, but generally it's not in the assembly. It's in smaller gatherings and stuff like that, and they don't make everybody start, you know, trying to speak in tongues and all that, which classical Pentecostals would.
As we're moving towards Pentecostalism, I need a neutral opinion.
All right. Well, if you mean neutral, that I don't have an opinion, you won't get it here.
No, I know that.
But I'll try to give you a balanced one.
Yeah, I'm looking for one, somebody who doesn't have a horse in my race.
Oh, I got you. There you go. Well, that would be the case here.
Yeah, so here's I have three little questions I'd like to ask.
Okay.
The first one is, and I have opinions on this, but I'd like to hear yours.
Sure.
Me giving them.
Okay.
Practicing tongues as an individual, practicing tongues in a church meeting that doesn't have unbelievers in it, and practicing tongues in a church meeting that does have unbelievers.
Mm-hmm.
Does Paul give clear instructions on these three things in 1 Corinthians 14?
I'd say it's pretty straightforward.
I think so, too.
Especially the last two, okay? Let's go backwards, okay? Our proof text here, or I should say our teaching text, is 14th chapter 1 Corinthians, where Paul goes into a lot of detail, though some of what he says in 1 Corinthians 12 and certainly 13 bear on this question in terms of proper understanding and 12 on the big picture and 13 on our attitude and our perspective and how we weight these things.
Right.
And then finally the instruction in chapter 14 that is meant to be corrected because there are problems on the gift of, on the use of tongues in the Corinthian church.
Yeah.
And I think it seems pretty clear, and it's the longest chapter and I don't know it really, really well, so I can't appeal to chapter and verse specifically here, but he does talk about tongues where there are non-believers, and if you have tongues where non-believers are present, people are going to think you're nutty.
Yeah, that,
if there are tongues without interpretation.
Yeah, that's 23 through 24.
So if everybody's just babbling on in tongues, you look like a bunch of idiots is basically what he's saying. And then he goes on to say, however, if you have prophecy, then the secrets of all of a person's heart is disclosed if it's bona fide prophecy. And he realizes that God can see into his heart as demonstrated by this prophecy, and he is convicted as a result of the miraculous gift that's in display at the church service. So here Paul is contrasting tongues, especially tongues without interpretation, so there's no content, with prophecy, which is contentful. And if you got non-believers present and everybody's speaking in tongues, it's chaotic, it's bizarre. Non-believers think these guys are nuts, I'm going out the back door. However, if a thoughtful word of prophecy is spoken that speaks something to that individual such that his heart is revealed in it, then he is convicted and he knows that God is in his presence, or rather, he's in the presence of God. I think that's the way Paul is arguing. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does. But my pastor threw in something I didn't think of. What about tongues with interpretation?
Well, I think tongues, remember Paul's playing this idea back and forth in 1 Corinthians 14, tongues without interpretations and tongues with interpretation. He said, you know, I speak in tongues more than you all, but I'd rather speak just one sentence with interpretation than, you know, the thousands without it, because this then serves the purpose that gifts are generally given to the body, and that is to edify the local body. All right. So I think that that would fall in the same category as prophecy. Tongues with interpretation works like a prophetic word. That would be my response right now.
Okay.
All right. So, and then with regard to the with believers in that circumstance, I think it's the same deal. You got tongues that are meant to be for the edification of the body, and tongues are not edifying the body unless they're interpreted. And so, therefore, Paul says, if you have a tongue, have an interpreter. Two or three prophesy. Couple of speak in tongues with an interpreter, edify the body. And if you don't have an interpreter, shut up. And he's pretty strong about that. And so, therefore, this practice of people like, on cue, okay, everybody blab in tongues. All right, everybody goes. I have no confidence, first of all, that most of those people are speaking in tongues.
Yeah.
And if they are, they're abusing their gift. Because Paul says specifically not to do that, and Pentecostal churches all over the country do that all the time.
Yeah.
Now, there may be a legitimate, and this goes to your first question, there may be, and then I have to go to break, there may be a legitimate prayer language that is not for the edification of the body with interpretation, but is a special prayer language, as some people call it, given by God I don't mean so much self-edification, but for self-use. It is somewhat edifying, I would grant. But for self-use, that is, that one can pray, as Paul says, you know, in to himself, speaking mysteries. And though the gift is given primarily for the church, it does seem that Paul makes enough reference, and that would be with interpretation, it does seem that Paul makes enough reference to it in the individual sense that there's a legitimacy to that as well. But it's not the main purpose of that gift. So I could go into, here are the verses that seem to suggest this to me. Now, I could be mistaken on that, but that would be my take at this point. That I think that there may be a legitimate gift for personal use, but that's for personal use. It's not for corporate use. So if everybody's doing it corporately out loud, this is a mistake, because that's the chaos that he's talking against in chapter 14. Those in the assembly, there should be either tongues with interpretation or a prophetic word or nothing, for the sake of the believers and also for the sake of the non-believers. So I think I covered the bases, giving you something to chew about on your three questions on this.
Thank you very much.
Okay, you work on it, and if you want to talk more about it, give me another call in a couple weeks. Okay, Rick?
Okay.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Okay, got to go to break, friends. I'll be back for our final segment of this hour and then more on Stand to Reason.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800-2 and the word reason. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org.
How would you like to spend a week aboard one of the finest ships in the sea, cruising the Alaskan coast, along with some of the brightest minds and skillful teachers in the world of Christian thought? Sound like a dream? Not anymore. Stand to Reason is having a cruise conference unlike any available today. We leave out of Seattle August 7, 2005, for 8 days aboard the MS Amsterdam. My friends J.P. Moreland, William Lane Craig, and Craig Hazen will join me in bringing you the tools and skills you need to confidently give an answer for your faith in the 21st century. Stunning ports of call, breathtaking scenery of the Alaskan coast, stimulating sessions with our speakers. This cruise is for you. Want to learn more? Call Inspiration Cruises and Tours at 800-247-1899. Their skilled staff will answer all your questions. Call them. There's no obligation. That's 800-247-1899. An Alaskan cruise, it's no longer a dream. It's for real. August 2005 with Stand to Reason. Call today, get a brochure, and I hope to see you there. Yeah. Yo, Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason, 1-800-227-5278. 1-800-227-5278 in the 714 area code 754-4150. And let's go. We got lines open here, folks, so I'd love to have you jump on board. And lots of time in the show. Vince, calling from Connecticut. You must be a web listener.
Hey, Greg. Yeah, definitely am.
Glad you called.
Enjoy your program. I listen to you on the web all the time.
Great. Is this your first time calling the show live?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
It is.
I'm glad you did.
Slightly nervous, but that's okay.
Oh, you sound great.
Oh, thank you.
You could be a talk show host yourself.
My golden-toned voice. I had a question about Sola Scriptura that I wanted to ask you about.
Sure.
Kind of how you might construct an argument with a Roman Catholic, like a pretty well-educated Roman Catholic.
Okay.
You know, at first you might look at the issue and say, well, obviously, you know, you want to just, you know, get your truth from Scripture, but it's not that easy necessarily to explain why.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering how you might...
Well, okay, a couple of preliminaries here. Has this friend of yours challenged you on this issue?
Not yet, but I'm expecting that we will get into the into the issue. I came out of the Catholic Church myself, which, like you did, I've heard you say that you did as well.
Okay, I did, yeah, and I've got a couple of thoughts. In fact, I was just thinking about this today,
mm-hmm.
talking about, with my wife about it, so I role-played some things, and I have them at my fingertips just in time for your question.
Well, I got my pencil ready.
All right, here's the first question. What does Sola Scriptura mean? Now, if you're going to claim to Sola Scriptura, you're going to need to know the answer to that question. If he's going to deny it,
mm-hmm.
he's going to need to know the answer to that question.
Right.
And I think most Catholics don't know what that means, and many Protestants don't as well.
Right.
So if he begins to challenge Sola Scriptura, my question is, well, what is it you understand Sola Scriptura to mean that you reject?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know what he's going to say.
Right.
Some might say that there's no truth except for in the Bible.
Yes.
And if that's the way they characterize it, then they are fair to ask this question. Is Sola Scriptura taught in the Bible?
Right.
And the answer is no, as far as I can tell.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, they say, well, if you believe as a truth that there is no truth except those truths taught in the Bible,
mm-hmm.
and Sola Scriptura is not taught in the Bible, then you cannot hold the Sola Scriptura. That would be using the suicide tactic against us. Our view becomes self-refuting at that point. You see that?
Exactly, yes.
Okay. But that's only if we hold the view that only the Bible is the only thing that gives us truth. Now, what's your profession?
Me? I'm a musician.
Okay. So do you know how to tune a guitar?
I sure do.
Do you know the truth about how to tune a guitar?
Well, yes.
Okay. Did you learn that in the Bible?
No.
Okay. So it's possible to learn truth outside of the Bible, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay, just a little tactical note. Notice in this illustration, I asked you what you did, and so I adapted my illustration to you.
Right. Okay,
okay, just something to keep in mind in the
yes.
future. So it's not the case that truth, that the Bible is the only place we find truth.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, there are lots of truths that aren't in the Bible. Now, the Bible is true, and it's true truth, as Francis Schaeffer put it, but it's not exhaustive truth.
Mm-hmm.
So I am not upended by a challenge of circularity or of self-refutation in my claim of Sola Scriptura,
okay.
Because I don't hold this definition that makes this challenge work.
Okay.
Sola Scriptura is not the idea that the Bible is the only thing that gives truth, and therefore, if that were the case, I'd have to find Sola Scriptura in the Bible. But I don't believe that's the definition of Sola Scriptura, and so I'm not constrained by that.
Okay.
Okay, so that takes a weapon out of his arsenal, and it's a weapon that's there just because he misunderstands.
Right.
If he wants to, assert that that's what sola scriptura means, then you could say, well, that isn't the sola scriptura that I believe.
Okay.
If you want to refute my belief, you got to deal with my belief, not somebody else's, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So what does sola scriptura mean? Sola scriptura means that the scripture alone is the authority, the inerrant authority, that is authoritative in itself. The scripture alone is the inerrant authority.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Roman Catholics disagree with that. They believe that the Bible is an inerrant authority. All right?
Correct.
They also believe that the
tradition, yes.
Sanctified tradition, mm-hmm. the teaching magisterium of the church, and the Pope speaking from the chair, ex cathedra. So they have four sources of inerrant information.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? You have one. Now, what is interesting, I just want you to observe something comparing your source of inerrant information with their four sources. Okay. Is there any similarity between yours and theirs? Your source of inerrant inspiration, inerrant authority is what?
Well, the Holy Spirit would speak through the Scripture.
Okay, you want to be very careful at this point. Let me just ask the question again.
Mm-hmm.
Your source of inerrant authority is what? What are we talking about?
Through the Bible.
The Bible, okay. Now, we know that's the Holy Spirit speaking through the Bible, but we don't want to say our source of inerrant authority is the Holy Spirit.
So that's what they're going to say.
Well, that's what a lot of people say, and then that's subjective. It's not testable. We want something third-person public. We both have access to it.
Yeah, okay.
That's the Bible. Now, we know these are the Spirit's words, so it is the Spirit speaking through the words of the Bible, but our focus is on the Bible. So we believe in the Bible. They believe in four things. What do they believe in?
The Bible and church tradition and the Pope speaking
from the chair and the teaching magisterium. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, do you notice that of the four things that they believe in, they also believe in the one thing that you believe in?
Yes.
So when we say that the Bible is an inerrant authority,
mm-hmm.
we are agreeing with them.
Yes.
They agree with our claim.
Mm-hmm.
They add three additional claims. Those three additional claims are the teaching magisterium, the Pope from the chair, and church tradition. Therefore, when it comes to a discussion about sola scriptura, I could say this. You know what? I'm open to other sources of inerrant revelation, but you're going to have to prove to me that those are legitimate sources of inerrant revelation on par with the Bible. All right?
Okay.
So, now, what do you have to prove in this debate?
I have to prove something that they already agree with.
That you have to prove nothing, in other words.
Right.
They already agree with your claim.
Mm-hmm.
You have nothing to prove. You're setting the sola from the scriptura, the sola scriptura, the only the Bible. You're setting the only aside for right now.
Okay.
You're saying, okay, well, I just believe in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Now, right now, I don't know that there's any other legitimate sources for God speaking, so for practical purposes, it's only the Bible. You got some other suggestions? All right, tell me about them. Why should I believe that the Pope or the teaching magisterium of the church or the holy tradition speaks with the same authority as the Scripture?
Mm-hmm.
The burden of proof is all on him. It's not on you. And this is a strategic and a tactical move here that is very important, and it's entirely legitimate. This isn't a trick to get you out from defending your view. The fact is he agrees with what you believe in. He says there's something more, and you're saying, well, I'm not sure, I'm not convinced, that's why I say only the Bible, but convince me.
Mm-hmm.
And I know their arguments are not very good. You know, it was not until Pope Gregory in the end of the 6th century that the Roman Church took on ascendancy. Before then, the Church wasn't governed by the bishop from Rome. In 325, You've got the Council of Nicaea. The Roman bishop sent two representatives just like everybody else. He wasn't a player there. He wasn't sitting on the throne making the decisions. Neither was Constantine, by the way. The players were different. Athanasius was one of them. Eusebius was another. And the heretic, another A guy, can't think of it right now. But these are the three guys that were the main players, not the Pope of Rome.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't like they started out like that. It went Peter, then to Rome, and then bingo, and everybody's following their lead.
Yes.
I mean, the history doesn't demonstrate that. It's not until the end of the 6th century, 570 to be specific, in Gregory. Mm-hmm. So easy to remember. So there are these. It isn't like the church practiced this to begin with. The Catholic Church didn't write the Bible. The Catholic Church didn't decide what was in the Bible, and therefore the Catholic Church doesn't have the right to tell you what it means.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes what the Catholic Church says about what the Bible means is completely opposite from the plain sense of the text itself.
Right. Yes, I would agree with that.
So these are all reasons why I shouldn't be listening to what, you know, I shouldn't believe this claim that they're the ones who have it. Now, unless they can give you powerful evidence that these other sources are in fact equally inspired with the Bible, then sola scriptura stands by default.
Right. Okay.
All right. Now, one last thought here, okay? Because there is another argument that they inveigh against you, mm-hmm. that you want to be alert to.
Okay.
And that argument is, what good is an inspired Bible without an inspired interpretation?
Right.
Have you heard this before?
I've read it in the Catechism.
Yes.
They're the ones that interpret.
Yes. Now, this goes bad in about four different ways.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. First of all, here's the claim. The Bible can't be understood on its own.
Mm-hmm.
Someone must interpret it. God wouldn't waste the Bible without giving us an inspired interpretation. So he has given us the church who knows what it means, who tells us. Okay, that's the way that works.
Yes.
Okay, good. And if he says this, then you can ask, clarify just so that you get it. Okay, can you produce me the book then, you ask, that is the Catholic Church's inspired interpretation on every verse in the Bible? They don't have one of those. They have dogma on a number of things, but they don't declare on everything.
They haven't necessarily gone through every scripture and given their own.
No, they don't have this. But you know what this means then? Then all of those verses that the Roman Catholic Church has not spoken specifically on are unintelligible,
mm-hmm.
which means they're useless to us, which means, in fact, God did give us a whole bunch of verses that we can't understand because he didn't give us a church that speaks on those things.
Right.
So their argument there caves in upon itself. Secondly, another problem is, who was the inspired interpreter for the people who received the writings to begin with? In other words, who gave the inspired interpretation to of 1 Corinthians to the 1 Corinthians?
Right.
In other words, they got this letter, right,
mm-hmm.
from Paul.
Yeah.
They said, hey, we got this letter. Is there any inspired interpreter around? Because we can't make sense of these words unless somebody tells us what they mean. Oh, we've got this entire inspired interpreter. Okay, now will you please interpret this for us? No, they read the letter.
Yeah, well, that's a great point.
Now, why can they understand it, but we can't?
Right.
Well, maybe we've been removed somewhat in distance and, okay, fine. Well, then we could study some of the things that they thought and said and kind of do our background work, and fine, we can do that. Well, Rome's going to have to do that too, it seems to me. There's one other problem that I can point out here, and that is that this problem of interpretation cannot be avoided. All right? So I'm going to end this last 60 seconds here before the top of the hour.
Okay.
You read this in the Catechism, right?
Yes, sir.
What the heck does a catechism mean? And by the way, what is the catechism anyway, if it's not an interpretation of the encyclicals and what the teaching magisterium itself has said? The teaching magisterium gives its interpretation, then it must be interpreted by the catechism, and then when you read the catechism, you're going to have to interpret what the catechism means. There has to be an interpretation at some level. You can't possibly avoid it, short of a Vulcan mind meld, okay? Great conversation, Vince. Keep up the good work. Give me a call in a few weeks or months when you have your encounter, and we'll talk more about it. Hour number one behind us, hour two ahead. Open lines 1-800-227-5278 and in the 714 area code 754-4150. I'm Greg Kokel, standing by for hour number two on Stand to Reason.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
I would like to ask you a very important question.
Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason. Thank you for joining me, hour number two. And I'm very happy to spend this next hour with you. With you every Sundays, 3 until 5, talking about the critical issues of life, ethics, values, and religion. By the way, I'm going to be out in Simi Valley this week. I forgot to tell you last hour. Twice, in fact. And I hope to see you at one of the two events. This is out in kind of the west end of the San Fernando Valley, kind of the east end of Ventura County. And Thursday evening, February 24th, that'll be Thursday next, I will be at the First Baptist Church of Simi Valley starting at 7 o'clock. There's a series going on there that Biola is sponsoring, and I'll be talking about the heathen and the unknown God, and I look forward to seeing you then. The number to call, 888-332-4652. Melinda, these numbers posted on our website when, okay, so if you go to str.org and click my face there in the upper right-hand corner, you get my schedule and the details here. Following Saturday, that would be Thursday next, and then 2 days later, Saturday, February 26th, I'll be at the Cochran Street Baptist Church in Simi Valley. Well, why is that a hard one there? And I'll be talking on a whole host of subjects starting at 8:30 in the morning and on through the afternoon. Relativism, only one question, embryonic stem cell research. I'll talk about the Colombo tactic, which is the most important tactic you can learn. So we're covering all kinds of things that day, and we hope that you can show up there at the Cochran Street Baptist Church in Simi Valley starting at 8:30 in the morning, February 26th. So that's Thursday, February 24th, in the evening at 7 at the First Baptist Church of Simi, and then it's on Saturday morning at 8:30, and for the rest of the day, the Cochran Street Baptist Church. What is the deal with street today? Listen, I started the last hour talking a little bit more about an idea that surfaced in the filming that I participated in. Faith Under Fire with Lee Strobel. This airs on PAX TV. Some of you have watched it last season, and maybe some of the reruns. I got a chance to do one show or a portion of one show. Then I got taped last week. Or actually the week before last now, a little more than 10 days ago, for another session, I was taping opposite Deepak Chopra and kind of a Crossfire TV debate about the future of faith and the legitimacy of Christianity. They taped that for a lot longer than I thought they were going to during the session. They decided not to edit much out and do a whole show just with Deepak Chopra and myself, and that'll be airing in May. Again, don't call us. We don't know the exact date, but when we find out, we will post it. They're planning to air it during Sweeps Week, so that might help you pinpoint it a little bit, and that was very flattering to us because they thought well enough of the show that they thought this would be a good showcase of Faith Under Fire. So, but during that time, it was a very interesting, challenging conversation with Dr. Chopra, the number one New Age guru in the world, arguably. And one of the points that I wanted to make, and I had planned this strategically as I went in, generally when you have a debate like this or an interaction, an interview with an opposing guest, generally you want to think about some main themes that you want to focus in on. And I had some of those. And one of them is I wanted to emphasize that truth can be known and that as a Christian I'm not making a leap of faith, all right? I'm just not jumping off into the future. And this is one thing that came up. And one of the challenges that was offered me is the kind of thing that I think was meant – by Dr. Chopra to stump me, to stop me, to make me look foolish and narrow in an inappropriate way. And since I dealt with this kind of thing before, I had a response to him. And this has to do with the idea that just that Christians talk about the truth, they think they know the truth, and they are certain of the truth, but big deal. Essentially, Dr. Chopra said, the Hindu is certain he's right, and the Muslim is certain he's right, and the Buddhist is certain he's right. And I added, Dr. Chopra is certain he's right. And so he's meaning to dismiss my point of view as just one of many, and no one can know. Now, he doesn't take that same approach to his own point of view, but it's just this dismissal. And it reminded me of something I thought of, an illustration I thought of a few years ago. You know, some people are smart and some people are dumb. Those people that are smart are usually smart enough to know they're smart. But some people are too dumb to know they're dumb, and they think they're smart. So you have one group of people, they think they're smart, which is divided into two smaller groups, one that is smart because they know they're smart, and the other one that's too dumb to know they're dumb and think they're smart. Now, here's my question. Do you think you're smart? And if you think you're smart, do you think you're smart because you really are smart and you know it, or because you're too dumb to know how dumb you are? Now, how do you resolve this dilemma? There's a very easy solution to this. How do you know whether you're really smart or not? Think about it. What divides the smart people from the dumb people? Generally, those things dumb people dread. Tests. In other words, you can know whether you're smart or dumb by taking a test regarding the thing that you think you're smart about. Then we'll know. And the test separates the men from the boys. In other words, and here's the point, you gotta have more than psychological confidence. You see, in this group of people who thought they were smart, in which some were smart and some were too dumb to know they were dumb and thought they were smart, they all had the same psychological confidence. Ladies and gentlemen, one of the hardest things about doing the work that I do is encountering smart people all around the world who are utterly convinced that they're right. I mean, they know it for sure. There's no possibility they could be wrong. They're more confident about their views than I am about mine. I have psychological confidence, but they've got more. And it's not just one person, it's lots of people who believe lots of different things. Guess what? All those things can't be true. They have contradictory truth claims. Everybody can't be right. Either Jesus is the Messiah or he's not the Messiah, but he's not both. When you die, you go to heaven or hell. You go to reincarnated. You go to astral worlds. You lay in the grave, but you can't do them all. Somebody's mistaken. Amongst these people who all have massive amounts of psychological confidence. How do you separate the men from the boys, the truth from the error? You got to take a test. That is, you've got to have more than psychological confidence. You have to have something objective that can be brought into the discussion to point out who's right and who's wrong. Another way of putting it is, you have to have evidence. You have to have some facts you can appeal to. You have to have arguments that can be sustained. It's not enough just to have the feelings. And this is the danger of Mr. Chopra's position, where he goes principally on feeling, not on, as he put it, dogma. But of course, Dr. Chopra has his dogma. In fact, he has his religious dogma. Everybody in the game does. That is, they have their non-negotiable religious beliefs that they think are absolutely true, and they're quite convinced, convinced enough to sell millions of books declaring these truths to people all over the world. So how do we separate the men from the boys? There's got to be more than just this feeling. There's got to be more than just this personal experience or psychological confidence. You know, Paul gave his testimony. He talked about his experience. We can read about it at least twice in the book of Acts, but he gave more than that. He said, I met Jesus Christ on the road to Emmaus because he died on the cross and was raised again from the dead 3 days later. It is the resurrected Christ and the fact of same that secures the legitimacy of Paul's experience. You see, he had a test for his experience. And so here's the question that Dr. Chopra hit me with out of the blue. And it was at a moment in the discussion that the tide had changed significantly. And I guess I want to say in my favor, because Dr. Chopra had primarily up until this point been talking to Lee Strobel, which is all right. I mentioned this last week. There's nothing wrong with that. But and since Lee's asking the questions, fine. But they like it when you can interact a little bit more. And I was trying to address Dr. Chopra. At some point, Dr. Chopra started going after me. And I think he started going after me because he felt he was losing some ground. It's my assessment. You can judge for yourself when you watch it. And that's why he had to take his focus off of Lee Strobel and start challenging me. And here is one of the challenges that he offered me. I mentioned it earlier. I'm certain that I'm right, but the Hindu and the Muslim and the Buddhist are certain they're right. So it was a way of dismissing my view as being no better than anyone else's, and it was a perfect opening for opportunity for me to make the point that I've just been making. You're right, Dr. Chopra. All of these people have the exact same psychological confidence. This is why, to be genuinely confident in the truthfulness of our views, we have to have more than psychological confidence. We have to have objective reasons. We can't be taking a blind leap of faith based on our religious wishful thinking. We've got to have more than that. And this is what protects me from these people that I run into all the time who I think are just as convinced or maybe even more convinced than I am that they are right, who have more psychological confidence than me. I realize if that's all I'm going on, I'm in deep yogurt here. How do I know I'm right? And they're not. Well, it can't be just based on my psychological confidence, can it? I've got to go to the facts. And this is why good ambassadors for Christ are ready and equipped to produce arguments, give reasons, grounding, justification for why our view is sustained by more than just our psychological confidence. We need to be able to provide the test that adjudicates between all of these different people who can't all possibly be right, even though they are each convinced they are. And it's an important point to make there. It's an important point for us to pick up and to use ourselves. We've got to go beyond that. Ours is not a leap of faith. There's a difference between believe and make believe. Our beliefs are tied to reality, and we have reason to believe that's true because of the evidence that we bring to bear on the circumstances. Jesus rose from the dead. That's a pretty good start. We have good reason to believe it actually happened, and that's to where the Christian faith. Well, you could say it starts in terms of its defense. You could also say it ends there, because that's enough to do the job, but there is a lot more. 1-800-227-5278 if you're in the Orange County area, 754-4150 in the 714 area code. Give us a call. Jeff is online here. Jeff, you're next. What's up?
Hi, Greg. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess some of this is related to this conversation or this what you spoke with Deepak Chopra about objective truth or absolute truth.
Mm-hmm.
I've recently become aware of a movie. I've had a couple of clients who have mentioned this movie they've seen recently. It's called What the Bleep Do We Know?
Yeah, I've heard of this.
I didn't know if you'd seen it or not.
I haven't seen it.
See it and maybe comment it on sometime. Mm-hmm. But from my understanding, it's somewhat comes from that postmodern point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to explain everything on through like quantum mechanics.
Right, okay.
For instance, they try to demonstrate that one thing can be in two places at the same time. They try to say that Christ was able to do or what he was doing because, you know, he was master mm-hmm. quantum mechanics.
By the way, I think that one thing could be in two places at one time too, but not something physical.
Right.
These are what universals are.
Correct. Well, some of these, I think they were using this for like almost like on a spiritual sense, like maybe sometimes you have a sense that somebody else is in the room with you, and maybe it's your grandmother who's back east thinking of you, and
mm-hmm.
have people try to explain it on those on that basis.
Well, wait, but then the question, here's the question then, and I know people are doing a lot of speculation with quantum physics. I'm not clever in quantum physics, but I do know a couple of things. I know some basic mistakes that people make, okay? in this. I also know. So I want to talk about one basic mistake that people make in this. Secondly, I want to just talk about quantum physics very generally. And then what we can do is we can look at specific claims. And even though we're not experts in quantum physics, we can make, look at specific claims and see if they bear fruit. Okay, if they cash out the way people think they do. Okay, the first general claim is quantum physics is highly speculative. Everybody in the field knows this. Very exciting, a lot of possibilities. It's a really weird world. For those who are not in the know about these terms, quantum physics deals with physics at the quantum level. The quantum level is anything subatomic. Okay? So when you're talking about quarks and all these little bitty things smaller than atoms, then you're talking about the quantum level. And when you enter into the quantum world, apparently everything gets really, really weird. It's hard to figure out things. One of the things that contributed to the growth of the quantum world was some work that Heisenberg did. And I don't know all of what he's done, but he produced a principle. And this was based on the observation that if you want to measure the speed of an electron and its location, you can't do both because your measurement interferes with the process. If you measure its location, you alter its speed. If you measure its speed, you alter its location, which means you can't measure both of them. Okay, now this is the mistake that I think is often made with people who talk about quantum physics. I heard this mistake come up, by the way, in another movie, the second Jurassic Park.
Okay.
One of the characters made this comment about Heisenberg, and I've actually heard it in debates in lots of different places. And what they've done, as far as I know, that's true, what he found out. The Heisenberg, did I just lose something? Hold on, there we go.
Okay.
You can hear me all right?
Yeah.
Oh, I know what I did. I bumped my volume so it went down and I thought I went out. Okay, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, as far as I know, as stated, is sound. But people have stretched it beyond that, and they've made it into an epistemological principle. And the epistemological principle is if you measure it, you change it. Or even if you observe it, you change it. Okay? You follow me so far?
Yeah.
Because when you try to measure the electron, you change something about it. You try to measure the location, you change the speed. Try to measure the speed, you change the location. So strictly speaking, even with the electron, you're not totally changing it. You're getting some true information, but you are not able to get the other information because you've interfered with it. It doesn't follow from that every observation we make changes what we are observing. And by the way, even if it changed what we were observing, it doesn't follow that we're not observing the way the thing really is. It only follows that what we're observing now is not the way it was.
Is that their perspective? That we change things because we observe?
Yes, this is part of this whole quantum thing. And this is the way people go epistemologically with this. And let me repeat what I said just a moment ago, that even if it did, our observations changed everything. It wouldn't follow that what we're observing isn't accurate and true and real. It would only follow that what we're now observing isn't what it was before, that we intervened and changed it to something else. That's something else we are now accurately observing. Do you follow me there?
Yeah.
So even taken at its face value, this distortion of Heisenberg doesn't give people what they want, which is radical skepticism and relativism.
Right.
Okay? So you'll hear this pop up in different conversations. It's an abuse. It's just simply an abuse of this notion, okay? Now, when it comes to these other things that people say, well, we got a break here, right? Okay, let me come back to this call, all right? But I want to put you on hold for just a second here, Jeff, and we'll come back because I have one more point to make about this, and it's worth pursuing a little bit more because this whole thing about quantum mechanics comes up on a regular basis or semi-regular basis, and you don't need to be an expert in quantum mechanics to know when mistakes are being made in the thinking about them if you're careful to observe what's being said. So we'll get back to that reflection in just a moment. I'm Greg Kokol. You're listening to Stand to Reason, and be back after this message.
Do you have an important decision to make in your life? Are you looking for God's guidance or leading before you move ahead with the decision you're currently faced with? Well, Greg's teaching on decision-making and the will of God, available on audio cassette or CD, takes you through the scriptures to provide the tools you need to make sound choices. After hearing Greg's teaching, you'll experience a deeper sense of relief and freedom in decision-making than you've ever known before. You'll understand how reading scripture carefully makes a difference in many different issues, including making decisions. Decision Making and the Will of God is available today from Stand to Reason in audio cassette or CD format. Extensive notes are included to help you with your study. Simply go to www.str.org or call the office at 800-2-REASON and order Decision Making and the Will of God today. You'll be glad you did.
Hi, this is Hugh Hewitt. Want to make a difference for a Christianity worth thinking about? Stand to Reason can help you do just that. STR trains Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting in your area and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You will learn how to deliver a message that is accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a manner that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting STR Radio today. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800-2-REASON or send your gift to 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. Again, 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. And thank you for listening.
Is this hillbilly music?
Hallelujah, I'm ready. Hallelujah. I can hear the voices singing something low.
Greg Kokel, your host here, giving you something worth thinking about every Sunday, 3 to 5 on Stand to Reason. And giving you a piece of my mind, hopefully at the same time. Talking with Jeff right now. By the way, Orange County lines are open. If you're listening in from the 714 area code, we got a wide open lines there. 1-8, make that 714 area code. That would be 754-4150. Let's go back to Jeff. Jeff, we still got you?
Yes.
Okay, Jeff. We're talking about quantum physics.
Right.
And the relationship of the whole quantum world and what they're learning about quantum physics to the whole Christian project, and we both acknowledge that we don't know much about quantum physics, okay? But that doesn't mean we are not in a position to do some assessment to the claims, all right? And I pointed out, for one, that this is a field that's very speculative, so we got to be careful about the kind of conclusions we draw generally. Secondly, so people can speculate, maybe they're right, maybe they're not. We just don't want to act like that. That's gospel just because a quantum physicist said it. Okay. Secondly, there is some misunderstanding by rank and file people with certain things like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. They take this difficulty in measurement and they translate it into a broad epistemological principle that makes everything relative. And that's not a legitimate application of Heisenberg. One other observation, I think, and this is something I've seen in the discussions about quantum mechanics relative to how we perceive reality. You know, there are two issues at stake when you want to know something. One is the way the thing actually is, and the second one is how we know the way the thing actually is. Okay? So the first is a metaphysical or ontological question. A thing is in itself a certain way. The second one is an epistemological question, how we could know that, how we could discover that, okay?
Okay.
That's two different questions. To go back to Heisenberg for a moment. If he's right about his principle, then we can make a choice of either measuring the speed or the location of electron, but we can't measure both at the same time. Because measuring the speed changes the location of the electron doesn't mean the electron doesn't have a location. Just because we're not able to find it or we can't determine it doesn't mean that it is indeterminate in itself. It isn't anywhere. We can't find where it's at because it's not anywhere. Or if we measure the location, the problem in measuring the speed isn't because it's not speeding, it's not moving, it's just because we can't get there from here. And that's the distinction between the metaphysical or ontological existence of the thing in a certain way and us being able to discover the way it actually exists. A lot of the discussion of – you understand the distinction there, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And keep your ears open for this when you see these movies and whatever. People mix these categories up. They think since you can't know it, it's unknowable in principle. Since we don't know the way something really is, then it is indeterminate in itself. Now, I think that a lot of conclusions that have been drawn from quantum physics make this error. They say, look it, every time we measure it, we change it. Therefore, we can't know the way it is in itself. Therefore, it isn't any way in particular. They jump from the epistemological difficulty to making claims about the metaphysics of the thing itself, and that's a big mistake.
Yeah. So it seems like the conclusion doesn't follow.
You're exactly right. You're exactly right. So just keep your ear peeled now, and any of you listening, if you get into these discussions about quantum physics, which really I think, and here's the thing for us, is a lot of these discussions are meant to try to show you, because what we've learned through quantum physics is that the world is not anything in particular. There is no determinate reality. And all of these quirky, weird things. I said quirky, not quirky, although that might be kind of a pun. In any event, one of the things that you said you saw in the movie is that since they claim that a physical object can be – do they claim a physical object can be in two places at once?
I think – I didn't see the movie. I'm waiting to see it. It's been circulating in some of these like artsy type –
yeah, right. What the bleep –
quote-unquote artsy type.
Yeah,
features.
What the bleep do we know is the name of the movie. And maybe somebody who's seen it can call in and tell us about it. But I believe that there are things that could be in more than one place at one time. These are called universals, by the way. They are not physical things. A characteristic of physical things as far as we know is that they are located in space and they can't be in two places at once. Now, they said, apparently on this movie, they implied that this was the case, and then said this: if you feel like your grandmother or your Aunt Martha is in the room with you, maybe she is kind of in a quantum sense, even though she's living at the other end of the country. Something
right.
like that?
Or something along those lines.
Well, either your grandma is physically in two places at once, or she's not. Now, I suspect grandma probably has a pretty good idea where she's at, and the best thing to do is to call her. And if you think grandma's in the room with you and you don't see physical grandma, then physical grandma's body is not in two places at once. You might say, well, there's a sense that grandma's here, or spirit's here, or her consciousness is floating around, but you see, that's not getting them what they want. If you're going to claim that a physical thing could be in two places at once, then that thing has to be physically in both places at the same time. And grandma, it seems to me, would know that. Yep, I was standing in your room and I was standing in my kitchen at the same time. I was aware of both places. In fact, my body was there. In fact, didn't you see me standing there? Because it was, in fact, my physical body. The reason I make this point is if they're going to make a claim, then whatever illustrations that they give to prove their claim have got to actually prove the claim. It's not enough for them to fudge and say, well, it's not really grandma's physical body. It's kind of like her spiritual sense or something like, I don't know what they said. But they've got to give concrete examples that support the claim itself.
Right.
My suspicion is lots of the claims that they give you and the examples they give that they think support the claim are going to turn out to be silly when you think about them. Not just like this is absurd, but I mean, you think you're going to be able to see how this isn't going to work the way they claim it's working. If you gave me more examples, maybe I could speak to that. Can you think of any more?
Well, I also along those lines, I think in the movie what I was told is they gave an example and they showed, I don't know if they were using some kind of subatomic particle or not, where they were looking through a lens or into this one room or a box where there's allegedly only one item in there, but yet it looked like it was two.
Okay, good. Okay, stop right there. Listen to the words you used.
Mm-hmm.
There was supposedly one item in there. But, what did you say?
They observed two.
No, that isn't what you said.
Well,
you said it looked like there were two.
Right. Again, this is just hearsay on my part. I have.
Right. I know. But even so, I think this is exactly the way it was. And I'm not trying to strain at your words like a gotcha thing. I'm trying to make the point. Do you remember the problem we just talked about a moment ago?
Right. Just because it appears that maybe there are two things in there doesn't mean there were.
Doesn't mean there are two things.
Yeah.
Is it an echo? Is it a reflection? I mean, there are lots of different ways to understand this. And by the way, maybe there are two things in there, and you didn't know it to begin with, and this test now revealed something that you didn't see in the past.
Right.
You know, there are all kinds of ways to understand this. So, and by the way, doesn't this raise another problem? I mean, think of it. You thought you saw one thing, and then we did this test, and two things appeared. Well, the reliability of seeing the two things in the second, or I should say, doesn't the fact that how can I put this? Well, here's the problem. they thought they saw one. Now they have evidence that they're two. But how are they perceiving the evidence of the two? They're perceiving it with the same eyes that thought the other thing was one.
Right.
So then what are they?
What are they? Conceived notion that there was only one thing in there, in a sense.
Well, I'm just saying if their eyes are faulty to look at the thing itself and see two when it looks like there's one, then why aren't the same eyes just as faulty when it looks at the evidence for the two and not know that maybe there's four or five or six things they're not seeing?
Mm.
You know, they still got to use their senses to assess this.
Right.
You know, I had a guy once tell me that the number one was not the number one. I said, well, if the number one's not the number one, then what are you referring to when you say the number one is not the number one? To what are you referring? Obviously, you're not referring to number one then. You know, if it's not what it is, then you must be referring to something else. But I don't know what you're referring to because you kept saying one and you said it's not that. By the same token, if your eyes are beholding something that is looks like one thing, but it's really two, the only way you know that it's two is because your eyes are now beholding two things. And maybe those two things your eyes are beholding are really four. I guess that part of the argument doesn't resonate with you, but anyway.
No.
You see what I'm saying here? So what's going? I think that this is a mix-up between the ontological and the epistemological, the metaphysical ontological and the epistemological, how things are in themselves and the way we see them. And I think Einstein made the same mistake when he says time slows down when things start moving towards the speed of light. I don't think time slows down. I think clocks slow down. You know, the only thing he's measuring time with is the clock. When things moving faster, the clock slows down, not the time. The clock is just a measurement of that. Anyway, there's some things to chew on, Jeff, okay?
Thank you so much, Greg.
It was good talking to you about quantum mechanics, of which I know very little. But though I admit that, ladies and gentlemen, keep in mind, it still is possible for us to look at things that people say and assess them from the outside. We can still see whether an argument makes sense or not, much of the time, whether their conclusion follows from the evidence, even though we're not intricately acquainted with the field itself, and that you can always use to your advantage. John, welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing okay, thanks.
Yeah, Greg, here's my question. I was listening to you a couple weeks ago, and I was just listening on your interpretation of how the Bible was inspired. And if I'm paraphrasing you correctly, you had said something to the effect that the Bible doesn't have to be like perfectly in alignment at all points or all salient points.
Okay, what I was making, that's okay, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, but in the second breath, you say, well, if God cannot lie, God cannot, you know, bear false witness, then the Bible has to be totally true. In other words, at one point, it sounded like you were saying it doesn't have to be perfectly true, but in the second point, because God is perfect, it has to be perfectly
yes,
true.
Yes, let me clarify that, and I appreciate you giving me an opportunity to make sense of this. I know exactly what you're talking about because I've said this many times, okay? There is a debate about the nature of the Bible, and the debate has to do with in what sense is the Bible the Word of God, if at all, all right? Is the Bible the ideas of God written by men? So it's the ideas that we can trust, but not necessarily the individual words. Or is the Bible true at all? In that, is it inspired by God in any sense? Now, I think this is an in-house debate among Christians about the nature of their doctrine of revelation. I think it's an important debate. Their doctrine of inspiration as well. I think it's an important debate. I think there are some answers to it. I think it's not an easy debate, but I think it's an in-house debate. And what I mean by that is one does not have to demonstrate that the Bible is from God in any sense in order to make the case for the truthfulness of Christianity. Okay? And the reason and the way I argue this is that the early Christians many of them were Gentiles and didn't have any Bible. They weren't Jews. The earliest Christians were Jews, but then later the Gentiles became Christians. They didn't have any Bible, and they didn't have an assembled New Testament. This is a mid to late first century. They didn't have these things, but they were Christians. So what was it that secured their Christianity for them without having a Bible? Do you know the answer to that?
Without having the Bible, what secured their...
In other words, what is it that made Christianity true?
Well, that the...
What was the substance of the Christianity?
That happened, Christ's resurrection.
There you go. The centrality of Christianity is the person of Jesus. What he did in history to save people and what he did to secure that salvation. He rose from the dead. So the death and resurrection... Broadly speaking, the details, and here's where the word salient comes in, the salient details, the major details of the life of Jesus, These are what establishes the legitimacy of Christianity as a religion, that it's true. So, if we have a reliable historical record of the salient details of Jesus' life, if we have testimony, either verbally, as the early church had, or written, as the church later came to have in the Gospels, that certain facts of history were indeed true, the life and death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, then we have what we need to demonstrate the truthfulness of Christianity.
Okay, now, Chris, if I can stop you right there. You say the salient points. Are you saying that maybe everyone doesn't have to cross their T's and dot their I's the same way, but overall the same facts are kind of put out?
Look, did Jesus say blessed are the meek or the blessed are the poor in spirit or thing? I mean, people could debate that. Well, let's say he didn't say that. Is that going to change? No, I'm just speaking for the sake of discussion for the moment, because I do believe he said that.
You're being like the devil's advocate.
Well, somewhat. I'm just trying to show you what's necessary for me to make my case.
Mm-hmm.
If you were a non-believer, I don't know if you are or not, but if you were and said, oh, the Bible, it's got all kinds of contradiction. I said, all right, so what? For my case, mm-hmm. proving Christianity, all I've got to show is that Jesus lived a certain life, died on a Roman cross, and rose from the dead 3 days later. I look at the claims that he made, his claims to be the Messiah, his claims to be God incarnate, which is the reason he was crucified, by the way. Are you the Christ, the Son of God? I am. Crucify him. If these claims are true, if any of the claims of his ability to control the forces of nature, to heal the sick, raise the dead, cast out demons, which are things that he did before many, many, many people, which is why there was such a following, which is why he was a big deal to begin with. If he was just this itinerant preacher who said the kind of nice things that the Jesus Seminar says he said, he would have never had a following and he never would have gotten himself killed. Okay? These things seem to have happened. There's no question by historians that Jesus was crucified on a Roman cross, buried in a grave. And so, given those details and the historical evidence that we have for the resurrection, I can make my case that Christianity is true without any of the rest of the Bible. Okay. Now, so that's what I mean by salient details. I don't have to have every single word that he said. I just got to have the major works, the broad evidence.
So you look at the big picture rather than all the,
I look at the big picture to demonstrate the truthfulness of Christianity.
Right, the important points.
Yes, but remember, I'm just talking about the truthfulness of Christianity as a worldview now.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when it comes to Christian growth, to going anywhere with God, as C.S. Lewis puts it, you got to have a map. Okay? You got to have some details. And there you need something much more detailed than just that Jesus lived and did these things and died and rose again. That's going to get you the truth of what Jesus said, and this is God. But now it'd be good to have a lot more detail about what Jesus said since he proved his claim to be God. And I think we do have that too. So, but that's another debate. So I just want to divide out these two debates. I don't want to give non-believers the debate, the in-house debate over inerrancy, as a reason to disregard Christianity,
right?
Because they don't think we can make our case.
Right.
It's irrelevant.
I like your answer. I really do. And here's a quick example of, you tell me if I'm seeing you correctly.
Okay.
Like, there's that one verse in the Bible, I don't have it in front of me, it just comes to mind as you're speaking, where, for example, right before Christ appeared on the Mount of Transfiguration with Moses and Elijah,
yeah.
He says to the apostle, Luke's gospel says, then 8 days later, but in one of the other gospels says like a week later. I mean, it doesn't really matter,
In this particular case, right. In this particular case, we have to keep in mind the genre. No, these guys are writing. And say, look, we do the same thing in talking. I just said last week I did this filming with Chopra. Well, actually, it wasn't last week. It was 9 days ago. But it was about a week ago.
Right.
So, and so I can use this kind of language. Well, the apostles did the same thing. They did not aim for strict chronology and strict accuracy and details that were irrelevant.
Right.
They summed things up. They spoke in general terms. They spoke in round numbers. Now, some rounded more than others. Some focused on one thing and not another. One guy you have two demoniacs there. In Mark 5, we see the demoniacs where Jesus, he cast the demons into the pigs and they all run, the legion and all that whole story. Well, one guy says two, the other guy says one. Well, one guy was talking about one, the other guy was talking about two.
Right.
They didn't say one and only one and two and only two. That would be a contradiction. It's just the way things are reported. They're precisely reported, but they're not intending to report it precisely, and so therefore it's not a contradiction.
Okay, now the second half, when you say God inspired everything, how would you rephrase
Okay, let me come back to that. Okay, John, I got to hold on just a minute. I'll come back to you. Going to break. We'll come back with the rest of John's question. I'm Greg Kokel for Standard Reason.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Standard Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org. How would you like to spend a week aboard one of the finest ships in the sea, cruising the Alaskan coast, along with some of the brightest minds and skillful teachers in the world of Christian thought? Sound like a dream? Not anymore. Stand to Reason is having a cruise conference unlike any available today. We leave out of Seattle August 7, 2005 for 8 days aboard the MS Amsterdam. My friends J.P. Moreland, William Lane Craig, and Craig Hazen will join me in bringing you the tools and skills you need to confidently give an answer for your faith in the 21st century. Stunning ports of call, breathtaking scenery of the Alaskan coast, stimulating sessions with our speakers. This cruise is for you. Want to learn more? Call Inspiration Cruises and Tours at 800-247-1899. Their skilled staff will answer all your questions. Call them. There's no obligation. That's 800-247-1899. An Alaskan cruise? It's no longer a dream. It's for real. August 2005 with Stand to Reason. Call today, get a brochure, and I hope to see you there. Greg Kokel giving you a piece of my mind, as I do every Sunday, 3 until 5. So if you're listening on the World Wide Web, as many do, and you want to talk directly to me, you may. 1-800-227-5278. 3 to 5 Sundays, Los Angeles time. Just do the calculations and give me a call, and we'll be glad to talk with you. Talking right now with John about inerrancy and the role that plays in the whole discussion. And so, okay, your next question is, how do I deal with the inerrancy issue? How do I demonstrate this?
Well, the second half of your answer was about how God does inspire the whole Bible.
Okay, yes. Let me put it this way. I can only do a little bit on this because we got other callers going here, but this is a much trickier issue. It's trickier because there seems to be a lot of counterexamples. The Bible claims to be God's word, all right? The text makes the claim for itself. The authors make cross-referenced claims for themselves. Jesus, who we just talked about, did these things and evidenced himself to be the one he claimed to be, the Son of God, also had full confidence in the entire Old Testament. In fact, Jesus quotes in the places that are most controversial: Adam and Eve, Jonah and the big fish, Sodom and Gomorrah, this kind of thing. You also see Jesus, quoting all of the Pentateuch as if Moses wrote it. All of Isaiah, both sections, first and second half, as if one author wrote it. So these are flying in the face of modern critical ideas. So he doesn't speak, obviously, of that which is to be written, not directly of the New Testament. That's a little trickier. But we have New Testament writers that are referring to each other in the area as Scripture. Now, if the Bible is God speaking in some vital sense, then it can't make an error. And the syllogism I gave was that if God, it's impossible for God to lie. It's also impossible for him to err. So if God can't err and the Bible is God's word, then the Bible can't err either. I think that's a sound syllogism. So then the question becomes, given that it claims to be God's word and we assume since that God and we know that God can't err, then what do we make of the alleged errors? Because if they are genuine errors, then that would prove that at least a portion of the Bible is not God's word. And this is where it becomes difficult in identifying exactly what the nature of the error is. And we just talked about one example just a few moments ago. Sometimes it is clear that ancient literature like this was not intended to be as precise as the New York Times in its reporting. Okay? They just had a different point of view about things. And if they didn't intend to give you the exact number of days, then it's not an error when they don't or when they disagree. If they are taking Jesus' words and they are not quoting him like Memorex, but they are rounding up. I mean, they're summing up what he's doing. They're giving the general sense of it. But frankly, some of these guys like John, he spent 3.5 years with Jesus. You know, Jesus was like a lot of itinerant preachers, even myself. He didn't just give his favorite talk once. He went to a lot of different places and gave the same talk, I'm sure, a number of times. That would make sense. And so we see different accounts of these kinds of things, and so we shouldn't be surprised when they have different ways of phrasing them. Or different writers might sum them up differently. They might organize different parts of the discourse differently to make a different point. They were free to do that in the way they wrote in the past, and they weren't intending to do chronological reports, for example. So when these things don't match up in that way, it's not fair to call them an error. And I only bring this up to say that there are a lot of things that people point to as obvious errors that that are not. It's not fair to call them errors. The list has been much bigger, and it's gotten much, much smaller as we've gone on in our learning. And so this is why I feel comfortable going with the testimony of the authors themselves that this is God speaking, and then I'll let time work out these details that I may not be able to answer, these apparent contradictions.
Thank you.
Does that help?
A lot. Thank
okay,
you.
John, great talking to you. Call again. And, good. I can go to some other callers now. I got a few, 10 more minutes? Let's do it. Matt, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi, Greg. How are you today?
Good, thank you.
Yeah, to me, the idea of there being multiple religious paths to truth makes perfect sense. Using an analogy of many different paths up to the top of a mountain,
sure.
Many different roads into a city. And I also believe that itself can be compatible with Christianity. In other words, there can be multiple paths to reality, and Christianity can be true, too. In the same sense that you said earlier, whether Jesus actually said, you know, the meek shall inherit the kingdom of heaven, or if that didn't actually happen, the basic claim of Christianity to bring a person to salvation, that's true. And I think it's possible the idea that Christianity is the only way to God could be a secondary error that really doesn't take away from the basic gist of Christianity.
Okay, let's look at this. How much have you studied Christianity, Matt?
I've studied it pretty well. I called your show before. I've actually studied the Eastern religions.
Okay, let me make a couple of comments just for about your opening illustration. First of all, you said it's possible for all religions to be true in the same sense that all roads lead to the top of the mountain. All right.
Yeah.
Now you know there's a difference, obviously, between an illustration and an argument.
Yeah.
Okay, just because you can make an illustration doesn't mean that you've argued for your case. In fact, the real question that we're facing right now is whether or not your illustration is an apt illustration given the thing we're discussing. For example, I could say, well, it's easy for me to understand that there are lots of ways to heal cancer. You could have surgery, or you could have chemotherapy, or you could have ice cream sundaes. Because, think of the illustration, there are many roads to the top of the mountain.
Sure.
Now you see that the nature of the thing in question, that is cancer, doesn't itself lend itself to, you know, an unlimited amount of solutions. There may be a couple of variations, but some are just not going to even be in play because of the nature of the thing itself. That's why I asked you so let's move then to the particular question that we're dealing with here. How one restores right relationship with God. Well, it seems to me, when it comes to Christianity, will it work? Let me just, instead of looking at all religions right now, let's just go to the claim that Christianity is compatible with this kind of inclusivism or pluralism. Will it actually work from the Christian perspective that it's one of many types of reality. And the problem is that in order to be reconciled with God, you first have to, that is, get to God. If you're thinking about getting to God, there's a sense that there must be a separation of some sort, or at least we think there's a separation. That means there's a problem that we have to assess, and then we have to get the right assessment of the problem in order to apply the right solution, just like in medicine. The assessment that the Bible makes is that, and this is the assessment throughout the Bible, and I'm sure you're aware of this from your studies, and Jesus as well, that man has rebelled against God, he is culpable for his sin, and his sin needs to be forgiven before he can be restored to God, which is why Jesus died on the cross when he was in the Garden of Gethsemane. He pled with the Father, is there any other way, essentially? But no, since there's not, I will go, even though I don't want to in one sense, I will go through this horrible death because it's the only solution for salvation. He says in Matthew chapter 5, I was just reading it today, or maybe it's chapter 6, let me see if I can find it quickly. He says, the road is narrow, or it's Matthew 7, verse 13. This is Jesus now, who is the central figure of Christianity. Enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide, and the way is broad that leads to destruction, and many are those who enter by it. For the gate is small, and the way is narrow that leads to life, and few are those who find it. Next verse, beware of the false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, and inwardly are ravenous wolves. These are statements from Jesus which are not unique. That means there are many places where he says similar kinds of things. That certainly makes sense in light of the way he viewed the world, that it seems to me leaves absolutely no room for the application of many roads to the top of the mountain to this particular question, at least from Jesus' perspective.
Yeah, I see your point of view, but I found the same statements from Buddha, Krishna, and other Eastern prophets saying the same exact thing.
Well, good.
The road to life is very difficult. And I'm just saying, could it be possible at least that there are, do you entertain at least the possibility that there can be, that God has created different religious paths to truth in the same way there's different paths, say, up a mountain? Do you believe
it? No, I think that it's theoretically possible. There's a possible world that God could have made that would have been like that. The real question, though, is whether this is that world. And it's interesting in your quoting of Buddha and others who said something much like Matthew, Jesus did and recorded in Matthew here, is that that really plays to my point, not to yours, that even these people, in their religious point of view, make it clear that their understanding of reality is correct, and it's not easy, but it's the correct, narrow way. It is also very clear that Buddha's way and the way of Hinduism are different. They're similar, but they're different.
Yeah.
They're radically different from Jesus' way. In fact, they're in two separate worlds. They're so different. We can't be talking about variations of the same thing, even though there are some similarities. It's the differences that are the most relevant.
But even within Buddhism and Hinduism, there's like multiple religious paths within Hinduism. There's multiple religious paths within Buddhism. And those religions encourage people, they don't say it's easy, but they encourage people to find a path within their own teaching.
I understand that. And that's why you can practice different asanas to get enlightenment. But that's presuming their view is true. If Hinduism is true, what they're saying is that the Hindu view of the world is correct, and there are many ways within the Hindu view of the world to kind of get enlightenment. But that isn't what Jesus is saying.
But you yourself earlier had said not every single thing in the Bible could be correct, and Christianity could still be true. Use the example of the meek shall inherit the earth. You said that might not really have happened, yet the basic claim of Christianity can be true.
That's correct.
What I'm arguing is the idea that Christianity is the only path to God, that could be something else that isn't literally true, that's something that's false.
No, listen,
it could still be
no question. I agree entirely. I could be totally mistaken on my view. Jesus could be totally mistaken on his view. But if we're mistaken, we're mistaken, let's face it. It isn't like this is a legitimate way and it's fine and true for us, and then other ways are equally true from God's perspective. Either Jesus was right or he was wrong. Christianity is not a pluralistic religion. If you love pluralism, don't flirt with Christianity. Go to Hinduism.
But Christianity was a pluralistic religion up until 312 when Constantine converted.
This is
there were
false.
Many different.
I am reading from Matthew, which was written within 30 years of the death of Christ. I'm reading from Matthew. I'm not reading from Constantine. You have to deal with the text here, not what you think Constantine did, because most people are very confused on what they think Constantine did. It's irrelevant what Constantine did.
But you have to acknowledge that in the first years after Jesus, there was pluralism within the Christian.
This is false.
There were different groups interpreting Jesus different ways.
Yeah, so what were the Christians first called? What were they first referred to as a group?
I'm not sure, but
I'm sure they were referred to as the way, not a way, not many ways, not some way, but the way. That was the name that they went by. Mm-hmm. After that, later on in Antioch, people started calling Christians, and it was kind of like calling Moonies, you know, it's like it was a put-down, but it stuck.
Exactly, and at that time, weren't the Christians considered the heretics? They were the bad guys?
Sure.
The Jews thought that the Christians were the bad guys, the heretics,
yes,
and the Romans thought, who are these crazy Christians?
Okay, and Matt, and my last thought on this, thank you for the call, that proves my point. It proves my point because if it wasn't pluralistic religion, if it was, nobody would be considered Christians the bad guys. Nowadays, the Christians who are the bad guys are not the pluralists like you. Everybody loves them. It's the people who think their way is the way, which is what the early Christians were called. Thank you for the call, Matt. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen. That's it for today. I'll be back next week, same time, same station. In the meantime, be good. Ambassadors for Christ, with an accurately informed mind, knowledge, an artful method, wisdom, and an attractive manner character. I'm Greg Kokel. For Stand to Reason, give them heaven this week, friends. Bye-bye.